Hello and welcome to a special crossover episode of ESG Talk and Off the Books. I'm your host, Steve Soder, accounting enthusiast and Diet Coke aficionado. I'm thrilled to be joined by my co-hosts from ESG Talk, Mandy McReynolds and Andy Wood. Today, we're discussing what's top of mind in corporate America, the SEC's highly anticipated and long-awaited final rule on corporate climate disclosure requirements. The three of us will dissect and analyze the requirements, and later in the episode, we'll also be joined by two guests who will discuss the implications of this rule for companies, investors, and the broader landscape of ESG reporting. Mandy and Andy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. So great to be with you all again.
Well, in case you wanted a quick overview of what the SEC adopted recently, I'm happy to provide it. So the SEC did soften its original proposal, but did indeed adopt rules for 10Ks and public offering documents that still may be challenging. Assured greenhouse gas emissions will still be required for the largest companies, but only Scope 1 and Scope 2, and only if they are material. The SEC did permit this climate data to be disclosed in an amended 10K or the company's second quarter 10Q so that it matches typical sustainability reporting timing. The TCFD, ISSB aligned disclosures on climate risks and their impacts, plus how companies assess and manage them, were largely unchanged from the proposal and somewhat similar, although with some changes to the proposal. A new financial statement footnote will be required that shows the impact of climate-related events if the aggregated amounts exceed 1% of pre-tax income or a separate threshold for total shareholder equity. Now, this part may be exceptionally challenging for companies since financial statements are subject to internal controls over financial reporting and a company's financial statement audit. So going forward, to some degree, perhaps many or all of a company's financial results now may need to be measured in part at least through the lens of climate-related impacts. Now, clearly, we did not include all of the 900 pages worth of provisions in the rule and my brief summary there, but that does bring me to my first question. In what way is this rule a landmark moment for ESG reporting? Mandy, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, thanks so much, Steve. And coffee lover, not Diet Coke lover. We always have this great debate every time we do a crossover episode, and I definitely got my caffeine. The way that I look at it is, this is really elevating what was typically non-traditional financial data and saying we see these non-traditional financial data as a way that the investors can make decisions in the capital markets. And so I looked at it not as a softened rule. I looked at it as a landmark opportunity to really think about trust and confidence. Everything in the rule was about trust and confidence. And even the things that were softened, if you dig in and see the public comments and the debates and the things that were changed, the reason that they were changed were because of a lack of confidence or trust, not because of necessarily a softening of a law. And we can dig into that a little bit more, but I saw it as a historic moment where now non-traditional financial data in the US is viewed as financially relevant. And we have the opportunity for ESG teams, finance teams, and risk teams to have incredible dialogue. And so now is the time for teams to come together and engage in change management when a law is helping drive confidence and accountability. So what a great moment for teams to step up to the plate and deliver that transparency with confidence. Andy, what are your thoughts?
Well, I am the token European in this group, so I think it's kind of my job both to mention that I like Diet Coke and coffee, and to sort of talk about what the SEC climate ruling means in that broader landscape. I think it's really interesting the way that it's being talked about as unprecedented and landmark, and we're hearing all this language about how important and new and interesting it is to the companies that are affected in the US market. But what I find sort of really interesting about it is the way that if we're looking from another perspective, it's really solidifying in a sort of a landmark moment, the way that climate is truly global as an issue and as a reporting topic and as something that absolutely needs to be elevated to the same level as financial reporting. I think there's always been this sort of moment where everybody sort of looks to the US and looks to the time it's taking to work its way towards climate reporting and has wondered if maybe that's a sign. And I think this means we're kind of past that sign. But it kind of leaves what was potentially quite a large gap now filled and filled with something that is going to be trustworthy data, which is very, very important.
Well, I want to dig into the CSRD relationship. We'll get to that in just a minute, because I do think it would be helpful for us to just talk about what are your reactions to the biggest changes from the proposal.
I didn't feel that many, I mean, obviously they were talked about significantly in advance. I didn't feel many were that surprising. I think something I thought was very notable was how strongly materiality came through. But it also raises some very, very interesting questions from that global perspective. Materiality is something that is frequently defined in local law globally, especially on the financial side. And then when we move into the sustainability space, as I know we'll get onto in a bit, we've got impact materiality and we've got double materiality. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see what that means for companies that are looking at producing those climate figures, the greenhouse gas emissions, and looking at assessing those risks and determining what is material in the different jurisdictions that they are reporting in.
I think building on what you said, Andy, one of the things that I looked at was how not only materiality, right, as you look at the rule and you unpack the rule, you know, it's mentioned several times, I think about 130 plus times in the rule. What I think is fascinating is if you do the same search on global standards, so looking at TCFD 230 plus times, more than materiality. If you look at GRI 18, SASB 19, ISSB 38, CSRD 29, and UK 24. So I look at all those inputs and I take a step back and I say, okay, yes, materiality was a big part of it. But these global frameworks and standards or voluntary frameworks really did help shape the direction. And if I were to call out anything for our listeners, I would say double down on TCFD based on just how much was input was taken in. Because what I thought was super interesting in the comments, even by the chair himself, was this is for U.S. markets. It was very clear that he was making a stake in the ground. However, if you look at then how the laws and regulations were shaped, and Steve, welcome your commentary on this, TCFD framework had a heavy play in how these were going to come through. And so what does that mean for practitioners? Well, I would challenge us then, I pay close attention to qual, I take close attention to governance, and I place close attention to how that is going to play out in your organization, because there may be more risk there than you think today.
Well, and I love that you brought up TCFD because, and like I think most everybody, still slowly working my way through the 900 pages. So I'm kind of working on fact sheets and anecdotes and, you know, kind of the quips and the responses that you see. But I was asked by somebody, Steve, if you had to sum up the rule as simply as possible, how would you do it? I kind of take a step back. It's like, well, you know, you've got your greenhouse gas emissions plus assurance. You've got the financial statement footnote. And then really, the rest is kind of TCFD. Again, I'm not the sustainability expert, but I mean, that's sort of the bulk of the requirements. And so I think you hit the nail right on the head. Now is definitely time to be paying attention to that. And not only how that would apply, I think, to your SEC reporting, but how that translates into what inevitably would be a broader sustainability report that would certainly include many, if not most, of your SEC reporting metrics, but then also anything else that would be relevant to your stakeholders to disclose. I think it's a terrific point there. Curious if both of you, you know, have reactions to how this might reshape methods of reporting financial and ESG data here in the U.S. and abroad. And if we want to get into the relationship of the CSRD, I do certainly think that would be relevant. Andy, do you want to get us started?
Oh, methods of reporting. So obviously, from my perspective, what we're looking at is the TCFD alignment is going to be really, really important here, because that is the baseline that was used globally for under ISSB standards, and of course TCFD is handed over in that direction, but it also underlines a lot of the framework principles in the European Sustainability Reporting Standards and the CSRD. But I think the thing that they all of these reporting moments have in common, and the clues in the TCFD name, what that F stands for, is that we're bringing the financial and the sustainability information together. And there's some think look at that and think, well, that's okay. There's some stuff in a document and it's come together. what's really important about that. But then we look at what it takes to get trustworthy, reliable data for both of those together in a way that allows teams to work together on financial statement information that is related to climate and on risk information that is related to climate and on financial information that is related to climate. And on you can kind of see there's a very interesting circle that starts to form there quite quickly. And I challenge somewhat the way that this is unprecedented. This isn't unprecedented. It's large and important. It has significant impact. And I think it will change some of the ways that people are getting towards their reports and their reporting methods. But it's not unprecedented. We do see teams already working together on governance and risk disclosures. We do see global organizations already looking at TCFD and taking the lessons from working on TCFD. And we have, admittedly, companies may have to look a little bit outside the United States to find it, but there is a lot of information and peer conversations that can be had with companies that know how to do this and have started down the road of how to do this. So even for the organizations within the US who are not affected by global regulation, who are not already looking at what ISSB means and how that affects their reporting, or even how CSRD and the big wave of the full set of ESG information and how that affects integrated and reporting, we'll be able to find people who can come and say, yeah, this is the kind of stuff that we're doing that is reshaping our process, but in a really good way.
I think I would build on that. Teams have to start now, right? Like there was this sort of market thing, like, oh, you know, even this week with discussions with colleagues around the world, it was like, okay, I just want to know, right? Like, okay, what is the actual rule so I can start to make better strategic decisions and time allocations of staff or needing to make consultancy plays or technology plays? And I think that's the piece is like, okay, now you know. Now you know. We have the CSRD out. We have the SEC out. So now let's really start to dig in on ownership and responsibility. And what I would challenge people on is looking at the disclosures, think about the qual side of governance, right? And I'll use our team as a very practical, real live example of as regulations are forming. So we release, you know, where does ESG, including climate responsibility, have a governance structure for our organization? We started in 3 years ago, like, let's have strong governance. That's our number one thing. Because it was important that it was cross-functional, it was important that the board had oversight. But that qualitative disclosure presents risk because it's in the sustainability report, but now it's some elements of it are in the proxy, but not all. Some elements were not even in the 10K. And so we made a strategic decision as a legal and finance team to begin to hone in that governance qualitative statement that goes across each and every one of our integrated reporting. So this year, it's a common disclosure that is the same and is not adapted by audience. But we also have to remember is that it's not just there that there's the risk. It's also that that governance ends up getting asked in supply chain RFPs. That governance disclosure also gets asked in CDP. It also gets asked in EcoVadis, which is the number one supplier review. And so we have to decide as a team, are we going to tweak that at all per audience? Or are we just going to say this is the common public disclosure and tag that everywhere we think that that data is going to go because it can present some risk to us of misinformation or mistransformation? So that's on the qual side. On the quant side, I think it was interesting, Steve, and welcome your comments there too around like, okay, you could do annual 10K or you could have this delay and send it out later. Well, I can tell you right now, going through internal audit, it was really interesting. We're working through our emissions calculation and the EPA released updated emissions in the middle of our internal audit before we go to external audit. So then there was this debate in the methodology where it was like, hey, okay, methods changed or you're updating in real time your sheets. That didn't match the control because the control was monthly, not ad hoc. And we as a team had to sync this week and discuss, okay, where is sort of that time cutoff for us, especially as we move forward and this might be integrated in a 10K or a later report. And so those are things you don't want to be making those kind of strategic decisions as a company on transparency and trust and risk and accountability, like 12 months from now before filing your 18. You want to be having that when you've got a long runway of time and the systems in place that you can have that thoughtful pacing dialogue and debate, and you're not under the pressure of trying to get to limited or reasonable assurance. And so that's a piece where I think it's life-changing for how teams can come together. But now you know, so act now. Don't wait to make those kind of strategic calls in the moment.
Yeah, I certainly think that delay timing, or at least option of delayed timing, is a bit of a lifeline. I'm anxious to ask the second part of this episode, our guests, what their perspectives are on that. From my standpoint, though, I think it actually goes right down to the planning, because extra time notwithstanding, an audit is kind of like a play, I guess, and you kind of want to be sure like the various acts or the various parts are all kind of orchestrating and seamlessly flowing together so that you can meet those deadlines. Regardless of whether you are taking advantage of the extra timing or not, when you're getting up close to that, that's certainly not the time to be having those kind of fundamental discussions. I do want to get into the CSRD just a little more specifically, and mostly with respect to how companies should prioritize the preparation. Candidly, and maybe with a little bit of levity here, I could kind of see folks in the EU looking at with the CSRD in the background, thinking, "Oh, how cute! Look what the Americans did for their climate disclosure." Of course, I say that a little bit in jest. But Mandy, and again, maybe we can start with you, and then Andy. Obviously, we need to get your reaction as well. How do you see the prioritization there? Because the jurisdictional boundaries aren't exactly the same. You can't say that if I comply with CSRD, that I'm inherently going to comply with all of the regulations that the SEC adopted. There are some differences there. So how do you think about prioritizing that preparation?
Well, I know I've shared this on ESG Talk and several times with practitioners, and I say it to our team probably every week. So people are probably sick of me saying it, but it's like, it is like tax, right? We're going to need to have global agreement that this is financially relevant information for stakeholders, investors, and consumers otherwise. And it is going to play out differently across international elements, across countries, across federal, and now if you add California, across states. And they were very clear in their comments, right, Steve? Like, they're not usurping California. So I that's the part where I tell practitioners is, when you look at these laws, whether you go from California up or you go from CSRD down, you have to really say, what is the highest standard? And if we are liable for that, then we need to prepare our readiness to that level. I think our team is leaning towards CSRD has a bigger scope. Double materiality is going to take a long time, a process, a very in-depth process to work through, where we've started roads towards that journey. And so I think it's that if you just think about SEC or you just think about California, then you're still going to be in this reactive mode. And it's better to kind of start at that higher level and think through what's coming 2 years down the road, 3 years down the road. Because, I mean, if you talk to anybody who's done double materiality well, it is not easy. And it is a depth of colliding your financial data with your impact data. And it will take a significant effort, just even different elements of that law. And that does not agree with the SEC materiality.
Oh, I love how we're back to materiality. It's almost as though it's inevitable. I think one of the things that we're definitely hearing, and people are starting to repeat more and more often, is this idea that CSRD effectively kind of does a GDPR. So because we're on ESG Talk and not general reg talk, I will expand that. That's the General Data Protection Regulation, which the EU introduced quite a while ago. And something that the world noticed quite rapidly was that it had kind of trickle effects. For a lot of organizations, because it had such effectively, value chain effects to it, it became a kind of baseline. Is the easiest way to comply everywhere was to pick the strictest, largest mandate, make sure that that was a good baseline, and then pull everything out of that, which in some ways, I think for some sometimes feels a little counterintuitive. It's like, well, surely I'm better off actually starting with the easier, lighter stuff. And then maybe even if I have to do that twice, that's still easier and lighter than starting with something that, you know, is a full ESG regulation. But in practice, I think that good solid data set, obviously there's then layers on top of that. There's what the disclosure requirements say, there's materiality and so on. But the thing that every one of these mandates has in common is the core data. Whether you're in climate, whether you're in the interactions between climate and other metrics, and for example, and social disclosures, whether you're into the interaction with governance, some of that might not necessarily be relevant to disclose in all jurisdictions, but the foundation that all of those things have to produce is very relevant for the organization's operations, and it's very relevant to the downstream results that you will be able to get out of the end of it. So I think we do hear CSRD being thought of as this kind of base by those organizations that know that they are going to be caught by that anyway. It provides that pretty solid data set, even if you're going to do a SEC disclosure and then pull the relevant pieces out of it. For me, it leaves so many interesting questions, though, about which disclosures are where. Obviously, we're expecting companies to still produce additional sustainability reports rather than move sustainability information to the 10K, because that would obviously then have significant ramifications, putting that extra information into the 10K. But what if it's already been through a strict process like CSRD anyway? What if you're a European company incorporating your annual report by reference, which will then include your full sustainability statements? I think there are so many interesting questions about what the different levels of reporting in different jurisdictions mean for how companies choose to distribute the information and communicate it, which channels in which jurisdictions, and how much difference it makes whether their scope 3 is available in 6 of their channels, but not their 10K or their 10Q.
Well, fascinating points, and as always, a terrific discussion. Eagerly await to see how this plays out over weeks, months, candidly, even years. As we get ready to wrap up the first part of this episode, I'm wondering if each of you could share maybe a brief 1 to 2 sentence piece of advice for companies who are going to get ready. I know that would be certainly a challenge for all of us to do that, but I don't have to. You guys are the guests.
You do have peers you can ask for precedence, for assistance, for having been through this experience before. Do go and ask them. It feels incredibly new, and I totally understand that, but it is possible to find past experiences that can help with this. It doesn't have to be done alone and from scratch. That's my main piece of advice.
I love it.
Yeah, I think I'll go back to the opening comments, is that I think as practitioners, whether you're in finance, legal, or ESG, is like, now is the time to lead change, right? This is a new opportunity to restore confidence with your stakeholders. But don't lose sight of the impact that that can have, right? And I think oftentimes we can get really lost in the weeds of compliance and forget that the objective is confidence.
Well, terrific responses. And now let's shift gears and welcome to the conversation Alan Wilson, a partner at the law firm of WilmerHale in Washington, D.C., and Jonathan Gregory, the North American Controller for M&A and ESG Accounting at the Hershey Company. We'll dive into a discussion on how companies should strategically approach the SEC's new climate disclosure rule.
A fancy accounting and finance honcho like you shouldn't be wasting time chasing data or copying and pasting numbers. No, use your fancy degree the way your parents always hoped you would. Workiva can help. Whether you're prepping or auditing annual reports or quarterly board presentations, you can use the Workiva platform to automate risky manual processes. Accelerate how you collect, report, and audit financial and non-financial data without sacrificing accuracy, so you can stand behind your story every time. Learn more at workiva.com/accounting.
Or workiva.com/risk.
Or workiva.com/ESG.
So the three of us I know have been talking now for 18 months, more than that actually, about what might be included in the final rule. So I'd love to hear from both of you. What was the most surprising change from the proposal back in 2022? And Alan, why don't we begin with you?
Sure. Thanks, Steve. I'm glad to be here. And it's certainly exciting to see the final rules get adopted after such a long wait. I think, you know, we've all had bets going in terms of what they would look like. And while we're still certainly processing less than 24 hours after adoption, one of the things that struck me most was the retention of the 1% threshold in the financial reporting section. I think I was certainly in the camp of folks who would have guessed that it would have been increased to 5% or something higher than 1%. But I'll note, and we can talk about it later, there were other accommodations made to the financial reporting section, which may have been taken into the calculus in terms of retaining the 1% threshold, notwithstanding that I think that that's still an interesting numeric to put in and to use for purposes of reporting.
Yeah, well, I think you and I are probably in that same camp. Jonathan, would love to hear from you. What surprised you?
Yeah, Steve, thanks for having me. I think the biggest surprise was that the SEC actually listened to some commenters during the comment period. And I know the SEC Pro Group was one of those organizations that put together a response letter around the timing of when it would make sense to even have some of this information available in SEC filings. So I think the biggest surprise was that you have actually until your Q2, 10Q to actually put this information into your SEC filings. And you don't have to rush and necessarily be making estimates to force it into a 10K by, call it, mid-February or March timeframes if you're a calendar year end.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. What's your take on the logistics of filing that climate information separately, such as, you know, your greenhouse gas disclosures, probably the assurance portion of it, within a Q2 report or maybe the amended 10K? How are you both thinking about that?
You know, at least here at Hershey, we have a dedicated sustainability and ESG team, and we've been best friends with that team from the controller and CAO perspective for a number of years. So maybe we're a little ahead of the game, but for organizations that kind of have to make up some ground in this area, giving that amount of time to actually data collect and actually be able to analyze and meet the specifications of the requirement, it certainly gives more time and is very helpful. I think the only question that I actually had coming out of that is certainly was not addressed yesterday, but what does that mean for ESG reports? I mean, these are typically published in the May to June timeframe, and there are a lot of organizations out there actually doing some level of limited assurance, whether it's on these metrics that are required under the SEC rule or just going beyond and getting limited assurance on other metrics throughout the entire document of their respective ESG reports. So it'll be interesting to see how things that have been happening for several years now at some companies with putting out a May or June timeframe ESG report, how that then dovetails into their Q2 filing. So that was actually a question I had for Alan. That's been burning in my mind since yesterday.
I think that's a great question. And it's one there. I think clients will certainly look to market practice at their peers, and you'll see this evolve. I don't yet have a good sense for how companies will navigate the path. I would say, as you think about the accommodation for delayed reporting as it relates to the emissions disclosure, it strikes me that companies would include that in a in the Q1 filing, perhaps that you file, you know, at the beginning of the year, as opposed to doing it in a 10KA. Could be wrong on that from a timing perspective. I think it depends in terms of where the cadence fits with the company's historic calendar. But there's really no strong preference to doing it with either one. It would still be filed in the document. So I think that placing it in the queue would be just as simple as amending the 10K and might be preferable. So you're not reopening sections of the 10K to put it into a different section. It seems easier and tidier for me to do it in a queue, but I could certainly see companies taking different positions on that. I think as it relates to their ESG and other sustainability reports, it's an open question in terms of what content remains in those and whether those actually get pared back based upon the information that goes in the K. I could see some companies taking that perspective to skinny down the workload and risk for duplication errors. But at the same point, if the information is disclosed similarly, you could imagine a scenario where the ESG reports are simply conformed to what goes into the 10K. So there is parity, but the information is just duplicated, relying on technology and other tools to ensure that it flows through and is the same source data, which I think will be a critical theme to ensure is in place going forward.
Well, I'm glad we're on the same page, Alan, because I feel a little bit more comfortable putting it into a 10Q versus reopening up a 10K and then having an amended statement out on the SEC website.
Well, you know, that's interesting that you brought that up, Jonathan, because I initially had that exact same reaction. Hey, I don't want a 10KA hanging out on EDGAR. At the same time, from a practical matter, I also don't know if I want to, I'll say, gum up my 10Q with a bunch of climate data. And again, gum up sounds negative. I don't mean it that way. But I wonder if the de facto says, okay, look, if you see a 10K A anytime from, you know, let's call it like April to July, then you just know that's where the climate data is going to be. One of the commentary that that I was going through yesterday talked about, you know, finding this data actually then might be a little bit difficult. Is it in a 10Q? Is it in a 10KA? And does that actually become a little bit of a challenge for people who intend to use this data, particularly investors and others, because there is some ambiguity about where it goes? I suspect a common practice will emerge, but it's interesting to think about the logistics of people pulling and actually using this data, however it ends up getting disclosed. One of the questions that I think is important is for us to talk about greenhouse gas emissions, if they're material and if they're disclosed, and we'll note that there is now a materiality, I don't know if I'd call it an exception, but certainly a materiality evaluation prior to Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions, but that will be subject to assurance for many companies. You know, Jonathan, you made a comment that many companies are doing limited assurance. How do you think that this requirement will now change the way that many companies are thinking about assurance, particularly to those who are doing it already?
No, it's a great question, Steve. And I could let Alan take the technical elements of whether something is material and whether or not it should be disclosed. But I think to answer the question on how should companies approach this, how will it differ from current practice here today is, you know, if you've not already become best friends with your ESG team and done gap assessments and internal reviews on readiness with this with the proposal that's now a final rule, now might be a great time to get that kicked off and started. You know, I know here at Hershey, again, we've done 1 year of limited assurance. That was last year was our first year doing it. And we'll have our ESG report coming out just in a few months with similar thought process. So, you know, we're building that muscle internally. It's training and helping and guiding the sustainability and ESG teams understand what it means to do a limited assurance audit. And, you know, making sure that they also know that reasonable assurance is down the path. It is still there. So this will transition over the next couple of years to almost the same level of intensity as your 10K audit, and just helping build that muscle, have controls, policies, build those policies, have some inventory management plans around your entire GHG footprint will be incredibly helpful. So I think the biggest thing is really doing that internal gap assessment and making sure that all parties and the right people are around the table talking on a periodic basis will help them out tremendously.
I agree with Jonathan wholeheartedly, as usual. He covers that incredibly well. I think about this, it reminds me a little bit of going back to SOX when it was first adopted over 20 years ago, and the processes that companies went through in order to get their systems built to the level that they needed to for purposes of audit over ICFR. And I think that in this case, it's the same type of activity, which is educating the relevant stakeholders and then coordinating the process and starting early to ensure that you have ample time to get to the audit and avoid the headaches that might be associated with waiting until a later point in time to get ready for that eventual audit, as you noted. The assurance, of course, is limited assurance, but that still is a rigorous undertaking, notwithstanding that it sounds easy. And then, you know, as you noted, for larger accelerated filers, that will ratchet up in 2033. So you've got a long horizon, but I suspect we'll be here sooner than one would think.
So we've talked about surprises to the rules. I'm wondering, just again, off the cuff, a quick take is fine. What do you see as the biggest challenges that'll emerge in order to comply with these rules? Alan, do you want to start?
Yeah. So from my perspective, part of it is really just digesting the volume of changes that are associated with this rulemaking in total and ensuring that the company has the relevant stakeholders around the table. I find that coordination can be certainly challenging, particularly where you have something as massive as this type of a disclosure change, because it does, as Jonathan alluded to, it requires so many different people at the company to actually contribute to the data that will be required to be reported. And the controls that are needed around that are difficult to implement and they take time. They're incredibly essential. And I think that ensuring that you have first a good understanding of what's required will take a lot of effort, as well as then building in the systems that are needed. And depending upon the issuer size, that may be more or less challenging. But I think for all companies, that will be one of the bigger challenges to overcome.
I would think just building off of that will be that a lot of the sustainability and ESG teams, they may have been used to disclosing this information in the reports in more of an unstructured, voluntary basis. But converting that and making sure that putting it into a very structured SEC-driven disclosure format, you know, still conveys the information that they do want to convey in terms of targets and goals and their progress towards those goals. So I think that'll be part of it. The other challenge, I think this was actually Alan's surprise in the beginning of this conversation, is still some of the materiality on the financial statement thresholds. So that would be something that I think a lot of more financial statement professionals will work on, as opposed to the sustainability and ESG teams, to make sure that that information can in fact be captured. And then turning around to your external auditors, because it's actually in the financial statements, to make sure that they're comfortable with the approach and methodology taken to either disclose or not disclose based on that 1% threshold. So I think that'll be the biggest challenge that most probably, again, more CAO, controllership, external reporting teams face, as opposed to ESG teams.
As you're both aware and have certainly seen, a lot of feedback already on this rule, of course, both positive and negative. But one of the questions that we've been asking ourselves is, how does this impact the relationship between ESG reporting and stakeholders and investors? Do you think this levels the playing field? Do you think that maybe there's still more information that needs to be disclosed? I think about scope 3, and not necessarily trying to make this a contentious discussion. I do wonder, could you now move the majority of your sustainability reporting into a 10Q or a 10KA and be done with it? Or are there still, just as a practical matter, additional things that you're going to want to disclose separately?
So I think, obviously, it's early days, and I think facts and circumstances for each company will matter. And those would include the investor base of the company and the demands of the investor, and really how ESG over the past couple of years and over the next 5 or 10 fits into the company's overall strategy. Because what we've seen, and I think you'll continue to see, is a demarcation in the market between those that are utilizing ESG in a manner as a competitive advantage, you know, for purposes other than compliance. Whereas here with the mandatory reporting, some might view this as a compliance function. So it levels the playing field in that respect, as you think about compliance across the board at a bare minimum, to your point, Steve. And then I think for those that choose to treat it as such, they'd be complying and they'd be providing more data relative to what they were historically, perhaps. But for those that actually are looking to seek and continue to maintain certain sustainability metric awards or to satisfy investor demands, I think you could still see supplemental data reported in ESG reports. And maybe that's the trend that you see, which is the moving of information to the 10K or Q, and then the use of a sustainability or an ESG report for the supplemental data that's outside anything from an assurance or controls perspective. I mean, really, it should still probably be subject to controls depending upon the nature of the data, but we could talk about that in a different context. But I think that it'll be the extra data that's outside this purview of the SEC, and it might be figuring out from the board level down how that fits into the strategy and where the resources need to be expended for the company's perspective to manage the expectations of itself and its investors.
Yeah, I agree. I agree, Alan. And I think the only thing that I'll really add is there's so much diversity in what companies are actually putting out in their voluntary statements. And even within, if you think about, you know, even here at Hershey, we have a certain number of key pillars, right? So we might have 5 or 6 key pillars. Environmental is one of those. But it's not all just limited to scope 1, 2, and 3 footprints. We can have other environmental factors that are not necessarily a part of the SEC rule. So it depends on the nature and the circumstances of what companies are putting into their ESG reports. I'll say it'll also play into what the SEC ultimately does around human capital, because we have a lot of work that is done inherently in ESG reports that would then have to come into an SEC filing. I'm hypothesizing there. But this same exact conversation, Steve, has come up even with CSRD, right? If you're a company that has to go out and do hundreds of data points and have assurance around it, what is really the purpose or the use of, you know, traditional ESG and sustainability reports? You might as well report on the metrics of a CSRD. I'm getting us off topic, but I think it's so early and there's so much diversity in practice that it'll really be a company by company choice in terms of what they keep as in a sustainability and ESG report versus what is a requirement, and to Alan's point, more of a compliance exercise.
Well, you know, you opened that door, and so I'll go through it just a tiny little bit. But it is interesting to think about what the eventual relationship will be from the SEC reporting requirements that that recently got adopted to the CSRD. And then the question is, well, if I comply with the CSRD, does that mean I'm covered for all of my SEC stuff? And I think the answer is some of it, maybe even most of it, certainly not all of it. And now you have to be managing these two processes that probably have various jurisdictional boundaries, potentially anyway. And I think that actually ends up complicating it a little bit more. I mean, again, early days yet for sure. But I do think that's going to be interesting to see how that plays out over time. Fabulous discussion. I'm just wondering quickly as we conclude, I'll ask you both the same question that I asked our hosts earlier. Any immediate advice for companies who are now preparing to comply with this rule? And maybe Alan, we'll start with you, and then Jonathan will give you the final word.
Yeah, absolutely. The biggest takeaway for me is to ensure that you're starting now to work with your financial reporting, your internal controls teams, any ESG and sustainability teams, and seeking to get those folks around the table together to begin planning now for the processes that will need to be put in place. And this, I think, applies universally, irrespective of whether you have already worked on that before or whether you're starting at point zero, because I think there's still more to be done now that we have a final rule and it's time to really start moving forward.
Well, from my side, Alan stole my last words, but I'll take it one step farther. And so from an internal perspective, make sure your CFO, and if you, to the extent you may or may not have a chief sustainability officer, make sure the right folks internally are understanding the implications. I mean, I already got an email this morning. To Alan's point, we're less than 24 hours from the rule, but my email was, make sure that we have something for our next audit committee meeting in terms of this rule, which makes total and complete sense. And that is obviously the direction in which we're heading, but making sure that the messaging, the education is all consistent throughout the organization. So I agree with Alan, plus that little extra tidbit.
Well, it has been a pleasure to chat with both of you here recording just less than 24 hours since the rule was adopted. Want to thank our audience. And with that, we will conclude this crossover episode on the SEC Climate Disclosure Rule. A big thank you to my ESG Talk co-hosts, Mandy and Andy, and guests Alan Wilson and Jonathan Gregory for sharing their insight with us today. And to our audience, again, thank you for tuning into this special episode of ESG Talk Not the Books, brought to you by Workiva, the world's only unified platform for financial reporting, ESG, audit, and risk. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate and review both shows on Apple Podcasts and subscribe to see future episodes on Apple, Spotify, or YouTube. We'll talk again soon.